brain the following false belief. I have an older brother living in Cleveland. Let us suppose the cognitive microneurosurgeon can do the requisite rewiring as much and as delicate as you please. This rewiring will either impair Tom's basic rationality or not. Consider the two outcomes. Tom is sitting in a bar and a friend asks, "Do you have any brothers or sisters?" Tom says, "Yes, I have an older brother living in Cleveland." "What's his name?" Now what is going to happen? Tom may reply, "Name? Whose name? Oh my gosh, what was I saying? I don't have an older brother. For a moment there, it seemed to me that I had an older brother living in Cleveland." Alternatively, he may say, "I don't know his name." And when pressed, he will deny all knowledge of this brother and assert things like, "I am an only child and I have an older brother living in Cleveland." In neither case has our cognitive microneurosurgeon succeeded in wiring a new belief. In the first case, Tom's intact rationality wipes out the lone, unsupported intruder as soon as it makes an appearance. An evanescent disposition to say, "I have an older brother living in Cleveland," isn't really a belief. It's more in the nature of a tic, like a manifestation of Tourette's syndrome. And if poor Tom persists with this pathology, as in the second alternative, his frank irrationality on the topic of older brothers disqualifies him as a believer. Anybody who doesn't understand that you can't be an only child and have an older brother living in Cleveland really doesn't understand the sentence he asserted. And what you really don't understand, you may parrot, but you can't believe. This science fiction example highlights the tacit presumption of mental competence that underlies all belief attributions. Unless you have an indefinitely extensible repertoire of ways to use your candidate belief, if that is what it is, in different contexts, it is not a belief in any remotely recognizable sense. If the surgeon has done the work delicately, preserving the competence of the brain, that brain will undo this handiwork as soon as the issue arises, or else, pathologically, the brain will surround the handiwork with layers of pearly confabulation. His name is Sebastian, and he's a circus acrobat who lives in a balloon. Such confabulation is not unknown. People suffering from Korsakoff syndrome, the amnesia that often afflicts alcoholics, can be astonishingly convincing in spinning tales of their remembered pasts that have not a shred of truth in them. But this very elaboration is clear evidence that the person doesn't just have an isolated proposition stored in her brain. Even a delusional belief requires the support of a host of non-delusional beliefs and the ability to acknowledge the implications of all this. If she doesn't believe her older brother also is male, breathing, west of Boston, north of Panama, and so on and so forth, then it would be worse than misleading to say that the surgeon's feat was inserting a belief. What this intuition pump shows is that nobody can have just one belief. You can't believe a dog has four legs without believing that legs are limbs and four is greater than three, etc. It shows other things as well, but I won't pause to enumerate them, nor will I try to say now how one might use a variation on this very specific thinking tool for other purposes, though you are invited to turn the knobs yourself to see what you come up with. I want to get a varied assortment of such thinking tools on display before we reflect more on their features. 15. Daddy is a doctor. A young child is asked what her father does, and she answers, "Daddy is a doctor." Does she believe what she says? In one sense, of course. But what would she have to know to really believe it? What if she had said, "Daddy is an arbitrager," or "Daddy is an actuary"? Suppose we suspect that she was speaking without understanding and decided to test her. Must she be able to produce paraphrases or to expand on her claim by saying her father cures sick people? Is it enough if she knows that Daddy's being a doctor precludes his being a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker? Does she know what a doctor is if she lacks the concept of a fake doctor, a quack, an unlicensed practitioner? For that matter, how much does she need to understand to know that Daddy is her father? Her adoptive father? Her biological father? Clearly, her understanding of what it is to be a doctor, as well as what it is to be a father, will grow over the years, and hence her understanding of her own sentence, "Daddy is a doctor," will grow. Can we specify in any non-arbitrary way how much she must know in order to understand this proposition completely. If understanding comes in degrees, as this example shows, then belief, which depends on understanding, must come in degrees as well, even for such mundane propositions as this. She sorta believes her father is a doctor, which is not to say she has reservations or doubts, but that she falls short of the understanding that is an important precondition for any useful concept of belief. 16. Manifest image and scientific image. It's time to erect some staging before proceeding in our quest to understand what meanings are. Here's a thinking tool that provides a valuable perspective on so many issues that it should be in everybody's kit, but so far it hasn't spread far from its home in philosophy. The philosopher Wilfred Sellers devised it in 1962 to clarify thinking on what science shows us about the world we live in. The manifest image is the world as it seems to us in everyday life, full of solid objects, colors and smells and tastes, voices and shadows, plants and animals, and people and all their stuff, not only tables and chairs, bridges and churches, dollars and contracts, but also such intangible things as songs, poems, opportunities, and free will. Think of all the puzzling questions that arise when we try to line up all those things with the things in the scientific image. Molecules, atoms, electrons, and quarks and their ilk. Is anything really solid? The physicist Sir Arthur Eddington wrote early in the 20th century about the two tables, the solid one of everyday experience, and the one composed of atoms widely separated in mainly empty space, more like a galaxy than a piece of wood. Some people said that what science showed was that nothing was really solid. Solidity was an illusion. But Eddington knew better than to go that far. Some people have said that color is an illusion. Is it? Electromagnetic radiation in the narrow range that accounts for human vision, the range in between infrared and ultraviolet, is not made of little colored things and atoms. Even gold atoms aren't colored. But still, color is not an illusion in the sense that matters. Nobody thinks Sony is lying when it says that its color televisions really show the world of color, or that Sherwin-Williams should be sued for fraud for selling us many different colors in the form of paint. How about dollars? These days, the vast majority of them aren't made of silver or even paper. They are virtual, made of information, not material, just like poems and promises. Does that mean they are an illusion? No, but don't hunt for them among the molecules. Sellers, 1962, page 1, famously said, "The aim of philosophy, abstractly formulated, is to understand how things in the broadest possible sense of the term hang together in the broadest possible sense of the term." That is the best definition of philosophy I have encountered. The task of figuring out how to put all the familiar things in our manifest image into registration with all the relatively unfamiliar things of the scientific image is not a job that scientists are especially well equipped to do. Please tell me, Dr. Physicist, just what a color is. Are there any colors according to your theory? Dr. Chemist, can you provide the chemical formula for a bargain? Surely, ding, there are bargains. What are they made of, Maybe there aren't any bargains, not really. But then, what's the difference, the chemical difference, between something that is a bargain and something that only seems to be a bargain? We could go on in this vein, looking at a host of puzzlers that only philosophers have tried hard to resolve. But instead, let's step back, as Sellers invites us to do, and look at the fact that there are these two remarkably different perspectives on the world. Why are there two? Or are there many? Let's try to answer this question by starting in the scientific image and seeing if we can spot the emergence of the manifest image from that vantage point. Every organism, whether a bacterium or a member of Homo sapiens, has a set of things in the world that matter to it, and which it therefore needs to discriminate and anticipate as best it can. Philosophers call a list of things deemed to exist an ontology, from the Greek word for thing. Surprise, surprise. Every organism thus has an ontology. Another name for it is the organism's Umwelt. Von Uexküll, 1957. Umwelt is the German word for environment, Surprise, surprise. An animal's umwelt consists in the first place of affordances, Gibson, 1979. Things to eat or mate with or shun, openings to walk through or look out of, holes to hide in, things to stand on, and so forth. An organism's umwelt is in one sense an inner environment, a subjective and even narcissistic ontology, composed of only the things that most matter to it. But its umwelt is not necessarily inner or subjective in the sense of being conscious. Umwelt is really an engineering concept. Consider the ontology of a computer-controlled elevator, the set of all the things it needs to keep track of in order to do its job. One of von Uxkull's studies was that of the umwelt of a tick. We may suppose that the umwelt of a starfish or worm or daisy is more like the ontology of the elevator than like our umwelt, which is, in fact, our manifest image. Our manifest image, unlike the daisy's ontology or umwelt, really is manifest, really is subjective in a strong sense. It's the world we live in, the world according to us. Like the daisy's ontology, however, much of our manifest image has been shaped by natural selection over eons and is part of our genetic heritage. One of my favorite examples of how different an umwelt can be compares an anteater to an insectivorous bird, Wimsatt, 1980. The bird tracks individual insects and must deal with their erratic flight patterns by having a high flicker fusion rate. In effect, it sees more frames per second than we do, and hence a movie would be like a slideshow to it. The anteater just averages over the whole ant-infested area and lets its big tongue take up the slack. A philosopher might say that ant, for an anteater, is a mass term, like water and ice and furniture, not a sortal, you can count them, like olives and raindrops and chairs. When an anteater sees a nice blob of ant, it slurps it up with its tongue, as oblivious to the individuals as we are to the individual glucose molecules we slurp up when we eat a sweet. Most of our manifest image is not genetically inherited. It is somehow inculcated in our early childhood experience. Words are a very important category of thing for us, and are the medium through which much of our manifest image is transmitted. But the capacity to categorize some events in the world as words and our desire to speak may well be at least partly a genetically inherited talent, like the bird's capacity to make out individual flying insects, or a wasp's desire to dig a nest. Even without grammar to knit them together into sentences, words as mere labels can help bring important categories into sharply focused existence in our manifest image. Mommy, doggy, cookie. Could you ever frame a clear concept of a bargain or a mistake or a promise, let alone a home run or a bachelor, without the help of the words I've just used to mention them? Our consideration of Doug Hofstetter's list of favorite thinking tools has already shown us how terms can structure and flavor our minds, enriching our personal manifest images with things, loose cannons and lip service and feedback, that are otherwise almost invisible. 17. Folk psychology. Probably the most important pattern in our manifest image, because it anchors so many other categories that matter to us, is the pattern I call folk psychology. I coined the term in its current meaning in 1981, but it apparently had an earlier incarnation in the writings of Wilhelm Wundt and Sigmund Freud and others, Volkspsychologie, where it meant something about national character, the Geist of the German folk. You don't want to know. This was an antecedent I had missed, as did many others who adopted the term. I proposed folk psychology as a term for the talent we all have for interpreting the people around us, and the animals and the robots and even the lowly thermostats as agents with information about the world they act in, beliefs, and the goals, desires, they strive to achieve, choosing the most reasonable course of action given their beliefs and desires. Some researchers like to call folk psychology theory of mind, or just TOM, but this strikes me as misleading, since it tends to prejudge the question of how we manage to have such a talent, suggesting that we have, and apply, a theory. In a similar spirit, we would have to say that you have a bicycle theory if you know how to ride a bicycle, And it's your nutrition theory that accounts for your ability to avoid starving to death and refrain from eating sand. This doesn't strike me as a useful way of thinking about these competences. Since everybody agrees that we have the interpretive talent, and everybody does not agree about how we manage to be so competent, I think it's best to keep theory out of it, and to use a somewhat more neutral term for the time being. Academic or scientific psychology is also in the business of explaining and predicting the minds of others, and it really does have theories. Behaviorism, cognitivism, neurocomputational models, gestalt psychology, and a host of others. Folk psychology is a talent we excel in without formal education. Folk physics, then, in parallel fashion, is the talent we have for expecting liquids to flow, unsupported things to drop, hot substances to burn us, water to quench our thirst, and rolling stones to gather no moss. It's another interesting question how our brains manage to generate these almost always correct expectations so effortlessly, even if we've never taken a physics course. Folk psychology is what everyone knows about their minds and the minds of others. People can feel pain or be hungry or thirsty and know the difference. They can remember events from their past, anticipate lots of things, see what is in front of their open eyes, hear what is said within earshot, deceive and be deceived, know where they are, recognize others, and so forth. The confidence with which we make these assumptions is breathtaking, given how little we know about what is actually going on inside the heads of these people, to say nothing of other animals. So sure are we about all this that it takes some strenuous distancing even to notice that we're doing it. Artists and philosophers agree on one thing. One of their self-appointed tasks is to make the familiar strange. Some of the great strokes of creative genius get us to break through the crust of excessive familiarity, jutsing into the new perspective where we can look at ordinary, obvious things with fresh eyes. Scientists couldn't agree more. Newton's mythic moment was asking himself the weird question about why the apple fell down from the tree. "Well, why wouldn't it?" asks the everyday non-genius. "It's heavy." As if this were a satisfactory explanation. If you are not blind and have blind friends, you will probably confirm my hunch that no matter how much time you've spent in their company, you still find yourself occasionally using your hands to point to things or draw explanatory shapes in front of their unseeing eyes in order to get them to believe and understand what you believe and understand. The default expectation when you are in the presence of another awake human being is that both of you can see the same things, hear the same things, smell the same things. You drive down the highway at 60 miles per hour, unperturbed by the fact that another car is coming your way in the opposite lane at the same speed. How do you know there won't be a terrible collision? You unthinkingly assume that the driver, whom you can't even see and almost certainly don't know, wants to stay alive and knows that the best way of doing that is staying on the right side of the road. Notice that all it would take to put you in a more anxious frame of mind would be a radio news report informing the world that a new robotic car driving system was being tested on your route today. Yes, it's designed to be safe, and after all, Google created it, but your confidence in the rationality and knowledge of the average oncoming human driver exceeds that of the vaunted robot, except perhaps late on Saturday night. How come everybody knows folk psychology? Is it, after all, Tom? A sort of theory that you learn as a child? Is any of it innate? Or, if we learn it all, how do we do that and when? There has been a flood of research on these questions in the last 30 years. My answer, still after all these years of research, is that it is not so much a theory as a practice, a way of investigating the world that comes so naturally it must have some genetic basis in our brains. You do have to learn some of this at mother's knee, and if you were somehow deprived of all contact with other human beings as you grew up, you would probably be strikingly inept in folk psychology, along with your other serious disabilities. But the urge is very strong to interpret things that move in irregular ways, unlike a pendulum or a ball rolling down a hill, as agents. A favorite demonstration of this in introductory psychology courses is a brief animation made using stop-action cinematography by Fritz Heider and Marianne Simmel in 1944. It shows two triangles and a circle moving around in and out of a box. The geometric shapes couldn't look less like people or animals, but it is almost irresistible to see their interactions as purposeful, driven by lust, fear, courage, and anger. This antique demo can be found on many websites, such as psychexchange.co.uk. We are born with an agent detection device, Barrett 2000, see also Dennett 1983, and it is on a hair trigger. When it misfires, as it often does in stressful circumstances, we tend to see ghosts, goblins, imps, leprechauns, fairies, gnomes, demons, and the like, where all that is really there are waving branches, toppling stone walls, or creaking doors. Dennett, 2006A. From an early age, we effortlessly and involuntarily see others as agents, and not just happy or angry or baffled or afraid, but as in on the secret or wondering which way to turn or even unwilling to accept the deal offered. It isn't brain surgery or rocket science. It's easy. The power and ease of use of folk psychology is due, I have argued, to the simplifying assumptions that enable it. It is like an idealized model in science, maximally abstract and stripped down to the essentials. I call this the intentional stance. 18. The intentional stance. So far, so good. Almost all of us are good at folk psychology. We have a talent for thinking of others and ourselves as having minds, a practice as effortless as breathing most of the time. We depend on it without a qualm or a second thought, and it is stupendously reliable. Why is it so easy and how does it work? Here we need to pause and erect some more staging, which will make life much easier for us as we proceed with our explorations. How does folk psychology work? We can get a good glimpse of the answer by noting how it works when we apply it to things that aren't other people. Suppose you're playing chess against a computer. You want to win, and the only good way of working toward that goal is to try to anticipate the computer's responses to your moves. If I move my bishop there, the computer would take it. If I moved the pawn instead, the computer would have to move its queen. How do you know what the computer would do? Have you looked inside? Have you studied its chess-playing program? Of course not. You don't have to. You make your confident predictions on the quite obvious assumptions that the computer, 1, knows the rules and knows how to play chess, 2, wants to win, and 3, will see these possibilities and opportunities for what they are and act accordingly, that is, rationally. In other words, you assume the computer is a good chess player, or at least not an idiotic, self-destructive chess player. You treat it, in other words, as if it were a human being with a mind. In still further other words, when you use folk psychology to anticipate and understand its moves, you have adopted the intentional stance. The intentional stance is the strategy of interpreting the behavior of an entity, person, animal, artifact, or whatever, by treating it as if it were a rational agent who governed its choice of action by a consideration of its beliefs and desires. The scare quotes around all these terms draw attention to the fact that some of their standard connotations may be set aside in the interests of exploiting their central features, their role in practical reasoning, and hence in the prediction of the behavior of practical reasoners. Anything that is usefully and voluminously predictable from the intentional stance is, by definition, an intentional system. And as we shall see, many fascinating and complicated things that don't have brains or eyes or ears or hands, and hence really don't have minds, are nevertheless intentional systems. Folk psychology's basic trick, that is to say, has some bonus applications outside the world of human interactions. We will see applications not just in computer technology and cognitive neuroscience, but also in evolutionary and developmental biology, to name the most important areas. I propose we simply postpone the worrisome question of what really has a mind, about what the proper domain of the intentional stance is. Whatever the right answer to that question is, if it has a right answer, this will not jeopardize the plain fact that the intentional stance works remarkably well as a prediction method in these other areas, almost as well as it works in our daily lives as folk psychologists dealing with other people. This move of mine annoys and frustrates some philosophers who want to blow the whistle and insist on properly settling the issue of what a mind, a belief, a desire is before taking another step. Define your terms, sir. No, I won't. That would be premature. I want to explore first the power and the extent of application of this good trick, the intentional stance. Once we see what it is good for and why, we can come back and ask ourselves if we still feel the need for formal, watertight definitions. My move is an instance of nibbling on a tough problem instead of trying to eat and digest the whole thing from the outset. Many of the thinking tools I will be demonstrating are good at nibbling, at roughly locating a few fixed points that will help us see the general shape of the problem. In Elbow Room, 1984A, I compared my method to the sculptor's method of roughing out the form in a block of marble, approaching the final surfaces cautiously, modestly, working by successive approximation. Many philosophers apparently cannot work that way and have to secure, or so they think, the utterly fixed boundaries of their problems and possible solutions before they can venture any hypotheses. The three stances. So let's see where the power of the intentional stance comes from, by comparing it with other tactics of anticipation. Let's begin by identifying three main stances, which could be subdivided further for some purposes, but not ours here. The physical stance, the design stance, and the intentional stance. The physical stance is simply the standard laborious method of the physical sciences, in which we use whatever we know about the laws of physics and the physical constitution of the things in question to devise our predictions. When I predict that a stone released from my hand will fall to the ground, I am using the physical stance. In general, for things that are neither alive nor artifacts, the physical stance is the only available strategy, though there are important exceptions, as we shall see. Every physical thing, whether designed or alive or not, is subject to the laws of physics, and hence behaves in ways that, in principle, can be explained and predicted from the physical stance. If the thing I release from my hand is an alarm clock or a goldfish, I make the same prediction about its downward trajectory on the same basis. Predicting the more interesting behaviors of alarm clocks and goldfish from the physical stance is seldom practical. Alarm clocks, being designed objects, unlike a stone, are also amenable to a fancier style of prediction. Prediction from the design stance. Suppose I categorize a novel object as an alarm clock. I can quickly reason that if I depress a few buttons just so, then sometime later the alarm clock will make a loud noise. I don't need to work out the specific physical laws that explain this marvelous regularity. I simply assume that it has a particular design, the design we call an alarm clock, and that it will function properly as designed. Design stance predictions are riskier than physical stance predictions because of the extra assumptions I have to take into account. 1. That an entity is designed as I supposed it to be, and 2. That it will operate according to that design, that is, it will not malfunction. Designed things are occasionally misdesigned and sometimes they break. Nothing that happens to or in a stone counts as its malfunctioning since it has no function in the first place. And if it breaks in two, the result is two stones, not a single broken stone. When a designed thing is fairly complicated, a chainsaw in contrast to an axe, for instance, the moderate price one pays in riskiness is more than compensated for by the tremendous ease of prediction. Nobody would prefer to fall back on the fundamental laws of physics to predict the behavior of a chainsaw when there is a handy diagram of its moving parts available to consult instead. An even riskier and swifter stance is our main topic, the intentional stance, a subspecies of the design stance in which the design thing is treated as an agent of sorts, with beliefs and desires and enough rationality to do what it ought to do given those beliefs and desires. An alarm clock is so simple that this fanciful anthropomorphism is, strictly speaking, unnecessary for our understanding of why it does what it does, but adoption of the intentional stance is more useful, indeed, well-nigh obligatory, when the artifact in question is much more complicated than an alarm clock. Let's slowly spell out the practice of adopting the intentional stance, focusing on our example of a chess-playing computer to make sure we aren't overlooking anything important. First, list the legal moves available to the computer when its turn to play comes up. Usually, there will be several dozen candidates. Now, rank the legal moves from best, wisest, most rational, to worst, stupidest, most self-defeating. Finally, make your prediction. The computer will make the best move. You may well not be sure what the best move is. The computer may appreciate the situation better than you do. But you can almost always eliminate all but four or five candidate moves, which still gives you tremendous predictive leverage. You could improve on this leverage and predict in advance exactly which move the computer will make, at a tremendous cost of time and effort, by falling back to the design stance. Get the source code, see Chapter 27, of the program, and then hand-simulate it, running through the millions or billions of tiny steps the computer will take in the course of finding its response to the move you are thinking of making. This will definitely tell you what the computer would do if you made your move, but the time clock would run out. Indeed, your life would be over long before you reached the conclusion. Too much information. But still, using the design stance is much easier than falling all the way back to the physical stance and trying to calculate the flow of electrons that results from pressing the computer's keys. So the physical stance is utterly impractical when trying to predict and explain the moves of the computer. And even the design stance is too much work, unless you get another computer to do it for you, which is cheating. The intentional stance finesses all that laborious information gathering and computation and riskily settles on a pretty good bet. The computer will be rational enough to find and make the best move, given what it wants, to win, and what it knows, the positions and powers of all the pieces on the board. In many situations, especially when the best move for the computer to make is so obvious it counts as a forced move or a no-brainer, the intentional stance can predict its move with well-nigh perfect accuracy, without much effort. It is obvious that the intentional stance works effectively when the goal is predicting a chess-playing computer, since its design purpose is to reason about the best move to make in the highly rationalistic setting of chess. If a computer program is running an oil refinery, it is almost equally obvious that its various moves will be made in response to its detection of conditions that more or less dictate what it should do, given its larger design purposes. Here the presumption of excellence or rationality of design stands out vividly, since an incompetent programmer's effort might yield a program that seldom did what the experts said it ought to do in the circumstances. When information systems, or control systems, are well designed, the rationales for their actions will be readily discernible and highly predictive, whether or not the engineers who wrote the programs attached comments to the source code explaining these rationales to onlookers as good practice dictates. More on this computer talk later. We needn't know anything about computer programming to predict the behavior of the system. We need to know about the rational demands of running an oil refinery. And now we can see why and how the intentional stance works to predict us. When we treat each other as intentional systems, we are similarly finessing our ignorance of the details of the processes going on in each other's skulls, and in our own, and relying unconsciously on the fact that, to a remarkably good first approximation, people are rational. If we are suddenly thrust into a novel human scenario, we can usually make sense of it effortlessly. Indeed, involuntarily, thanks to our innate ability to see what people ought to believe, the truth about what's put before them, and ought to desire, what's good for them. There is no controversy about the fecundity of our folk psychological anticipations, but much disagreement over how to explain this bounty. Do we learn dozens or hundreds or thousands of laws of nature along the lines of, if a person is awake with eyes open and facing a bus, he will tend to believe there is a bus in front of him. And, whenever people believe they can win favor at low cost to themselves, they will tend to cooperate with others, even strangers. Or are all these rough-cast laws generated on demand by an implicit sense that these are the rational responses under the circumstances. The latter, I claim. Whereas there are indeed plenty of stereotypic behavior patterns that can be encapsulated by such generalizations, which might in principle be learned one at a time as we go through life, it is actually hard to generate a science fictional scenario so novel, so unlike all other human predicaments, that people are simply unable to imagine how people might behave under those circumstances. What would you do if that happened to you? Is the natural question to ask. And along with such unhelpful responses as, I'd probably faint dead away, comes the tellingly rational answer. Well, I hope I'd be clever enough to see that I should do X. And when we see characters behaving oh so cleverly in these remarkably non-stereotypical settings, we have no difficulty understanding what they are doing and why. Like our capacity to understand entirely novel sentences of our natural languages, sentences we have never before heard in our lives. Our ability to make sense of the vast array of human interactions bespeaks a generative capacity that is to some degree innate in normal people. We just as naturally and unthinkingly extend the intentional stance to animals, a non-optional tactic if we are trying to catch a wily beast, and a useful tactic if we are trying to organize our understanding of the behaviors of simpler animals and even plants. The clam has its behaviors, and they are rational, given its limited outlook on the world. We are not surprised to learn that trees that are able to sense the slow encroachment of rivals, because more of the sunlight now falling on them is reflected off tall green things in the vicinity, shift resources into growing taller, faster. After all, that's the smart thing for a plant to do under those circumstances. Among artifacts, even the lowly thermostat can sustain a rudimentary intentional stance interpretation. It wants to keep the temperature at the level you ask it to, samples the temperature frequently to arrive at an up-to-date belief about the actual temperature, compares that to the desired temperature, and acts accordingly. This is what you might tell a young child to explain the point of the thermostat without getting technical. This simple theory of intentional systems is a theory about how and why we are able to make sense of the behaviors of so many complicated things by considering them as agents. It is not directly a theory of the internal mechanisms that somehow achieve the rational guidance thereby predicted. The intentional stance gives you the specs, the job description of an intentional system, what it should discriminate, remember, and do, for instance, and leaves the implementation of those specs to the engineers, or evolution and development, in the case of an intentional system that is an organism. Give me an agent that knows the difference between dollar bills and $10 bills, can make change, detect counterfeits, and is willing and able to deliver the product the customer wants 24 hours a day. This intentional stance characterization is either the specs for a vending machine or a rudimentary job description of a convenience store clerk, entirely noncommittal about what kind of innards or further talents the entity might have. This equivalence or neutrality is not a bug, but a feature, as the software engineers like to say. It permits intentional systems theory to play the chief organizing role in bridging the chasm of confusion between our minds and our brains, as we shall see in the next three chapters. Briefly, it allows us to see what is in common between real beliefs, the beliefs of persons, and mere belief-like states of vending machines, animals, young children, and most usefully, subpersonal parts of persons. To anticipate, we can use the intentional stance to give the specs of the competences of subsystems in the brain in advance of any detailed knowledge of how those competences are implemented. We analyze the big, fancy, real person into subpersonal agents with their own agendas and methods, and then analyze these in turn into yet simpler, stupider agents. Eventually, we arrive at intentional systems that are simple enough to describe without further help from the intentional stance, bridging the chasm between personal-level folk psychology and the subpersonal activities of neural circuits is a staggering task of imagination that benefits from this principled relaxation of the conditions that philosophers have tried to impose on, genuine adult, human belief and desire. Where on the downward slope to insensate thinghood does real believing and desiring stop and mere as-if believing and desiring take over? This demand for a bright line is ill-motivated, as we have already seen in Chapter 15, and we'll see again with the help of several other thinking tools. The use of the intentional stance in both computer science and animal psychology is ubiquitous, and intentional systems theory explains why this is so. Some theorists in evolutionary biology claim to do without it, but they are fooling themselves, as we shall see in the section on evolution. 19. The personal-subpersonal distinction. Your eyes don't see, you do. Your mouth doesn't enjoy chocolate cake, you do. Your brain doesn't abhor the stinging pain in your shoulder, you do. Your hand doesn't sign a contract, you do. Your body may be aroused, but you fall in love. This is not just a grammatical point, like the fact that we say, it's raining, when there's a thunderstorm, not the thunderstorm is raining, nor is it just a matter of definitional convention. People sometimes ask, dismissively, isn't this just semantics? Which is taken to mean that nothing much hangs on how we define our terms, but how we define our terms often does make a big difference. And this is one of those times. Our way of speaking about persons and what they can do and suffer is grounded in some important facts. At first blush, it seems that there are things a whole person can do that none of a person's proper parts can do. And this is almost right, but a ghoulish exercise of imagination suggests that if this is so, then a person is, roughly, a proper part of a human body, namely an intact and functioning brain. Do you have a brain, or are you a brain? Not a straightforward question to answer. If you cut off my arms, I can still sign a contract, with a pen in my toes or a vocal directive. But if you shut down my brain, nothing my arms and hands could do counts as signing a contract. Pluck out my eyes and I cannot see, unless I get fitted with prosthetic eyeballs, which are not such a distant science fiction fantasy. What if you start amputating parts of my brain? If you were to remove the occipital cortex while leaving my eyes and optic nerve intact, I would be cortically blind, but might still have some residual visual competence. For instance, the famous condition known as blindsight. No doubt we could amputate a bit more brain and wipe out the blind sight, while still leaving you a life to lead. The tempting idea is that such a process of elimination, removing hearing, touch, taste, and smell, could pare down the brain to the ultimate headquarters of you, and that is where and what a person would be. Tempting, but wrong. The brain's multitudinous competences are so intertwined and interacting that there simply is no central place in the brain where it all comes together for consciousness. For that matter, many of the competences, dispositions, preferences, and quirks that make you, you, depend on paths through your body outside your brain. The always popular philosophical thought experiment of the brain transplant, which would you rather be, the brain donor or the brain recipient, is enabled by a very distorting idealization. As I once put it, one cannot tear me from my body, leaving a nice clean edge. 1996A, page 77. Probably the most important property of the Internet is its decentralization. It has no hub or headquarters anywhere in the world where dropping a well-placed bomb would kill it. Its proper parts have a high degree of redundancy and versatility, so it degrades gracefully, if it degrades at all when any proper part of it is disabled. HAL, the intelligent computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey, has a logic memory center, a room full of memory cassettes that Dave can detach one by one, shutting HAL down for good. The Internet has no such center, and while nature has not equipped us with quite such a fine level of distributed invulnerability, there is still considerable decentralization of you in your body and considerable versatility in your parts. The organization of your brain proves to be remarkably plastic, able to morph into new configurations so that you can go on being you, pursuing your dreams, confounding your enemies, concocting your stratagems, reliving your trials and triumphs in spite of the removal of important but not quite vital bodily parts. That is one reason why you can have competences that none of your parts have. Or we can turn the point inside out. The only way to understand or make sense of the powers of the parts of a whole live body is to consider how they contribute to the coordination of the whole magnificent system. Consider a few more instances. Your brain doesn't understand English. You do. Your brain doesn't find the joke hilarious. You do. Even if the activities of competent structures in your brain play the major causal roles in your understanding and appreciation, they couldn't do their work without the training and support provided over the years by all your sense organs and limbs and other effectors. So it is not just conventional when we posit a person, the enduring, conscious, rational agent whose live body this is, as the subject of record for most of our everyday attributions. It is you who made the mistake, won the race, had a crush on Leslie, speak passable French, want to go to Brazil, prefer blondes, committed the libel. See also Chapter 62. You are hungry, tired, and peevish, all thanks to your subpersonal parts and nothing else. But then, what about those proper parts? Are they just like bricks stacked up into a living human body? The answer is yes, if we look at the smallest parts, atoms. But it is no at every other level, from the molecular to the cellular and higher. The proteins that are the workhorses inside your cells are amazingly competent and discriminating little robots, nanobots we might call them. The neurons that do most of the transmission and switching and adjusting work in your brain are more versatile and competent robots, microbots we might call them. They form coalitions that compete and cooperate in larger structures, communicating back and forth, suppressing each other, analyzing the flood of information from the senses, waking up dormant information structures in memory, which is not a separate place in the brain, and orchestrating the subtle cascades of signals that move your muscles when you act. All these levels, higher than the basic atomic building blocks, exhibit a degree of agency. In other words, they are interpretable as intentional systems. At the molecular level, motor proteins, DNA proofreading enzymes, gatekeepers at trillions of portals in the membranes of your cells and the like, their competences are very robotic, but still impressive, like the armies of marching brooms in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, or Maxwell's Demon, to take two fictional examples. At the cell level, the individual neurons are more exploratory in their behavior, poking around in search of better connections, changing their patterns of firing as a function of their recent experience. They are like prisoners or slaves rather than mere machines, like the protein nanobots. You might think of them as nerve cells in jail cells, myopically engaged in mass projects of which they have no inkling, but ever eager to improve their lot by changing their policies. At higher levels, the myopia begins to dissipate, as groups of cells, tracts, columns, ganglia, nuclei, take on specialized roles that are sensitive to ever wider conditions, including conditions in the external world. The sense of agency here is even stronger, because the jobs done require considerable discernment and even decision-making. These agents are like white-collar workers, analysts, and executives with particular responsibilities. But also, like white-collar workers everywhere, they have a healthy dose of competitive zeal and a willingness to appropriate any power they encounter in the course of their activities or even usurp control of any ill-defended activities engaged in by their neighbors or others in communication with them. When we reach agents at this level of competence, the subpersonal parts are intelligent bricks indeed, and we can begin to see, at least in sketchy outline, how we might fashion a whole comprehending person out of them. Some assembly required, as it says on the carton containing all the bicycle parts, but at least we don't have to cut and bend the metal and make the nuts and bolts. This idea that we can divide and conquer the daunting problem of imagining how a person could be composed of nothing but mindless molecules can be looked at bottom up, as we have just done, or top down, starting with the whole person and asking what smallish collection of very smart homunculi could conspire to do all the jobs that have to be done to keep a person going. Plato pioneered the top-down approach. His analysis of the soul into three agent-like parts, analogized to the guardians, the auxiliaries, and the workers, or the rational, the spirited, and the appetitive, was not a very good start, for reasons well analyzed over the last two millennia. Freud's id, ego, and superego of the last century was something of an improvement. But the enterprise of breaking down a whole mind into sub-minds really began to take shape with the invention of the computer and the birth of the field of artificial intelligence, AI, which at the outset had the explicit goal of analyzing the cognitive competences of a whole, adult, conscious, language-using person into a vast network of subpersonal specialists, such as the goal generator, the memory searcher, the plan evaluator, the perception analyzer, the sentence parser, and so on. 20. A cascade of homunculi. In the millennia-old quest to understand the mind, theorists have often succumbed to the temptation to imagine an inner agent, a little man, homunculus in Latin, who sits in the control room in the brain and does all the clever work. If you think of the human nervous system as, say, a huge telephone switchboard network, as thinkers like to do as recently as the 1950s and 1960s, you have the problem of the telephone operator at the center. Is his or her mind composed of a smaller telephone network with its own central operator, whose mind in turn is composed of... Any theory that posits such a central homunculus is doomed by the prospect of an infinite regress. But maybe the mistake isn't postulating a homunculus, but postulating a central homunculus. In my first book, Content and Consciousness, 1969, I made a big blunder. Tempted by a wisecrack I couldn't resist, I wrote, "The little man in the brain, Ryle's ghost in the machine, is a notorious non-solution to the problem of mind, and although it is not entirely out of the question that the brain-writing analogy will have some useful application, it does appear merely to replace the little man in the brain with a committee." Page 87. And what exactly is wrong with a committee? Aha, my implied reductio is called out. I eventually came to realize, in Brainstorms 1978A, that the idea of replacing the little man in the brain with a committee is not such a bad one. It is, I think, one of the fundamental good ideas of cognitive science. This was the classic strategy of GoFi, good old-fashioned artificial intelligence, Hoggeland, 1985, that came to be known as homuncular functionalism. The AI programmer begins with an intentionally characterized problem, and thus frankly views the computer anthropomorphically. If he solves the problem, he will say he has designed a computer that can, for example, understand questions in English. His first and highest level of design breaks the computer down into subsystems, each of which is given intentionally characterized tasks. He composes a flowchart of evaluators, rememberers, discriminators, overseers, and the like. These are homunculi with a vengeance. Each homunculus, in turn, is analyzed into smaller homunculi, but more important, into less clever homunculi. When the level is reached where the homunculi are no more than adders and subtractors, by the time they need only the intelligence to pick the larger of two numbers when directed to, they have been reduced to functionaries who can be replaced by a machine. Page 80. The particular virtue of this strategy is that it pulled the rug out from under the infinite regress objection. According to homuncular functionalism, the ominous infinite regress can be sidestepped, replaced by a finite regress that terminates, as just noted, in operators whose task is so dull they can be replaced by machines. The key insight was breaking up all the work we imagined being done by a central operator and distributing it around to lesser, stupider agents, whose work was distributed in turn, and so forth. This was a fine advance, but an unwanted artifact of the top-down approach of classic GoFi was its rigid bureaucratic efficiency. We may have been able to imagine getting rid of the central king or the CEO, but we still had an army of mid-level executives reporting to an array of vice presidents, whose interactions constituted the highest level of the system, and ordering their subordinates into action, who in turn would call up more menial clerical workers and so forth. This hyper-efficient organization, with no wasted motion, no feather-bedding, no insubordination, was largely dictated by the fact that the large computers on which the early AI models were developed were tiny and slow by today's standards, and people wanted results fast. If you needed to impress the funding agency, your AI had better not take hours to answer a simple question. It should be businesslike in its execution. Besides, writing thousands of lines of code is a lot of work. And if you have succeeded in breaking down the target task, answering questions about moon rocks or diagnosing kidney diseases, or playing chess, for instance, into a manageable set of subtasks that you can see how to program and then integrate into a workable system, you can have your proof of concept at a feasibly low cost in terms of time and money. Notice that computers have always been designed to keep needs and job performance almost entirely independent. Down in the hardware, the electric power is doled out even-handedly and abundantly. No circuits risk starving. At the software level, a benevolent scheduler system doles out machine cycles to whatever process has the highest priority. And although there may be a bidding mechanism of one sort or another that determines which processes get priority, this is an orderly queue, not a struggle for life. As Marx would have it, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. The computer scientist Eric Baum has aptly dubbed this hierarchy Politburo control. Probably a dim appreciation of this fact underlies the common folk intuition that a computer could never care about anything. Not because it is made out of the wrong materials, why should silicon be any less suitable a substrate for caring than carbon, but because its internal economy has no built-in risks or opportunities, so it doesn't have to care. Neurons are not like this. The general run of the cells that comprise our bodies are probably just willing slaves, rather like the selfless, sterile worker ants in a colony, doing stereotypic jobs and living out their lives in a relatively non-competitive, Marxist environment. But brain cells, I now think, must compete vigorously in a marketplace. For what? What could a neuron want? The energy and raw materials to continue to thrive, just like its unicellular eukaryote ancestors and more distant cousins, the bacteria and archaea. Neurons are biological robots of sorts. They are certainly not conscious in any rich sense. Remember, they are eukaryotic cells, akin to yeast cells or fungi. If individual neurons are conscious, then so is athlete's foot. But neurons, like their mindless unicellular cousins, are highly competent agents in a life-or-death struggle. Not in the environment between your toes, but in the demanding environment of the brain, where the victories go to the cells that can network more effectively, contribute to more influential trends at the virtual machine levels where large-scale human purposes and urges are discernible. Many of the subsystems in the nervous system are organized as opponent processes,